Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Or did I have to explain that?
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Did you actually clap then?
I did, didn't I?
It came through as like the weakest sounding little.
It's got a wheel. I've got a big line on my...
It sounded wheel. Like a bit of lettuce being dropped on a desk.
Hello and welcome to another IGN UK podcast. It's me, Simon Cardy, with Joe Screbbles.
Hello.
Hello. Matt Perslow, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Isn't this lovely to be
this is a very CBBC vibe you're bringing into the podcast
really?
This week.
Like one of those, they should get me onto one of those bedtime stories where they get all the celebs on, like Tom Hardy or whoever.
Yeah, I mean, you got a way to go, but
yeah,
we'll get you there.
Yeah, it's like, who's this? Who the hell is this? We don't want to scare the children.
He was that boy that was on BBC News.
For a whole, like, 6 seconds.
That's it. I don't think either of you like Always Sunny, but there's a bit in Always Sunny where someone's very excited about being on the news because he talked for 20 minutes about a bus crash, and then it's just, it was crazy! And that was basically Cardi's appearance on BBC News, as far as I understand it.
And they call me a gaming journalist, which I'm not. I'm not a journalist. But
you're
you
a critic!
It's parlance, isn't it? If they don't want to just write... Here's some guy talking about FIFA. Anyway,
yeah. I was once on a TV program about games, and I got referred to as a Nintendo expert, and I was annoyed. Ooh. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be known as a journalist in that instance, but
just,
not to
just
be.
Just write big nerd.
But I am on IMDb because of it, so it's all good.
I doubt I am. Let's talk about some films and games, because that's what we do on this podcast half of the time. Top Gun Maverick. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Did you fly into the danger zone, Cardi? Is that where
I
we're going?
I did. I was very lucky to see Top Gun Maverick this week, the sequel to Top Gun. if you weren't aware.
The sequel to Hot Shots Part 2.
Yes.
The sequel to Matthew Perslow's dad's favourite film of all time.
Exactly. Is your dad getting very excited?
Oh, God. All the way, you know, they kept delaying it. I just kept getting Facebook messages from him all the time, just going, when are they bringing it out? When is it coming out? It's like, just wait, Dad. They'll tell you soon.
He's got less than 2 weeks to wait. It is out on the 25th of May in the UK, I think a couple of days after in the US. And let me tell you, Mr. Perslow should be very excited for this film, Matt, because I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Can I ask, key to the Top Gun mystique is that when you go back and watch Top Gun, you realise that it doesn't have any plot. Like,
oh yeah,
it's a series of sketches without jokes about planes, and it's great.
It's very enjoyable.
Oh, it's amazing. I love it. Like, it's basically avant-garde cinema. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing to it. It's a slice of life for a fucking
this one is
volleyball
definitely
dick.
More plot heavy.
Okay,
I would say it's, you know, it's not a twisting turning plot. It's going very A to B, but what it is, it's set in the present day. It's set 36 years after the original. That's when the original came out, 36 years ago. And it does, again, follow Tom Cruise's Pete Mitchell, who, he looks good for his age, doesn't he?
Well, oh,
he
my
is
God.
A magical man.
I honestly forgot that his name wasn't just Maverick, like a Brazilian football player. Like, I genuinely forgot that character had a name.
I mean, everyone just calls him Mav or Maverick. No one really calls him Pete, really. He's still living as a Maverick, let me tell you. This far in the future that we call the present day. And what happens is, he's called back to Top Gun to get the best pilots in the US Navy prepared for a seemingly impossible mission. Do you see where this is going?
Yeah.
This is what I love about this film so much, is that you've got kind of... It plays all the greatest hits of the original, to the point where the same songs are playing, the same set piece happening. They're not playing volleyball this time, but there's a very similar scene. they hit all of those greatest hits for like the first half, two thirds of the film. And then at some point they just decide, right, let's make this a Mission Impossible film. And that's what I loved about it.
Great news.
So much. And it's so good, because from that point onwards, the last, I don't know, 40, 45 minutes, it is just non-stop, like, exhilaration. I was, like, so into it. Like, one of the best, like, not to, like, use any hyperbole, like, one of the best action films I've seen in cinema since, like, Mad Max. It was, like, that good. Like, Mission Impossible level stuff. Like, Fallout was excellent.
Mm.
It's reaching that sort of heights. But, like, the flying scenes are just breathtaking. And the fact that, like, they did this 99% practically as well. Mm. Like, Tom Cruise paid for some of his co-stars to have full flying lessons for this film, like, and it's a mad extent to go to, but it really does pay off. It's just unbelievable to look at.
In terms of those flying scenes, are they designed to feel dangerous or exhilarating? Because what that, like, flying or like getting the sense of flying, the last thing I can remember watching that like gave me that feeling was First Man, which is fucking like horror. But the first scene of First Man, where he's in that fucking test plane and it's juggling about it, and it feels like he's going to die and you're gonna die as well with him. I'm assuming this is more like flying's great as opposed to.
Yeah. I mean, it does have its moments of, of like, what, you're not quite sure what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely more on the like exciting, like, exhilarating part of the spectrum rather than, like terrifying. But like, it's just, I was just so into it. And like, it manages to balance it all as well. Like these like exhilarating action scenes, these like very, like, it's got a lot of the original is like, there's some very cheesy dialogue, very cheesy like 80s-esque moments in it, but then like it's like properly emotional at times as well. Like once or twice I properly was choking up, like, because there's obviously these connections to the original film. Miles Teller is playing Goose from the original film's son, so right. There's that.
I fucking love that they got Miles Teller in, a man who does not look like Goose, and did everything they could to make him look identical to Goose.
It works.
But, like, no one looks that much like their dad. I don't think that's possible. Like, it's so weird.
They give him the exact moustache and pair of glasses. It's like, he's, and, like wears the same, like, Hawaiian shirt.
That's
like,
so good. That's so funny.
It's, but, yeah, it really, really does work. I really just want to see it again. Like, and... And I'm going to say the annoying thing that everyone says, if you get the chance, I saw this in IMAX.
See it on the biggest screen exactly. possible.
If you have the chance to, really do, because it's incredible. And I wouldn't say seeing the original Top Gun is a necessity, because they do reference, they'll properly catch you up on what happened in the first. As we've already stated, there isn't a ton of plot to it anyway, but there is definitely one or two like key beats you'd want to know about. But yeah, you should watch the original Top Gun anyway, just because it's very, very fun. But yeah, are you guys excited?
Is it better than Top Gun?
Yes, I would say so.
That's good.
It's a much better film. Like, Top Gun is probably like a 7 out of 10 film. It's an enjoyable film. I don't think it's a masterpiece. It's very good for what it is. But this is like more like an 8 or 9, like very, very good action film. And I feel like people are going to watch the first half hour of this film and be like, what am I talking about? Because it is a bit of a, it starts very much like the original Top Gun for like the first half, but then once they start getting into the actual like mission part of it, it just turns into a much, much more exciting film, I think.
So the thing I want to know about it, Cardi, is I'm guessing the direction is good, but is there anything, because the thing I find interesting about it is directed by a guy who is primarily from a computer effects background. Yeah. Like, he did Tron Legacy, he did Oblivion, which is very CGI heavy, and like all of his other stuff is like, he did like the Gears of War commercial and stuff like that. So is he a good like practical director?
I think, well, from this, I would say yes. I mean, I've never actually seen Oblivion, I'll be honest, so I don't know.
I didn't think it was great.
No. I quite enjoy Tron Legacy for what it is.
Yeah,
and it's again him doing a sequel of an 80s film, so he's kind of got, you know, he likes doing that. But I think practically, I mean, a lot of the great stuff about the flying scenes are, they just put the camera in the cockpit, so you just kind of in the clock. They put the camera in the cockpit, so you're basically seeing a lot of the action just from people's faces as they're flying mm-hmm. around, and you can tell that. Imagine some of that isn't actually acting, but
absolute abject fear.
It's well directed. It's also like partly written by Christopher McQuarrie, who is responsible for a lot of the recent Mission mm-hmm. Impossible stuff with Tom Cruise. And I imagine Tom Cruise, you know, on any film he's on, he has a large like thumbprint on it. He's like basically shadow directing, I'm imagining, this film.
I can't remember who it was. Someone clever and cool on Twitter wrote
me.
Like, no, wrote something like, this plus the last two Mission Impossible films effectively make Tom Cruise like an auteur director without directing anything. Like, mm-hmm. he just makes one genre of film, and it's yeah. the Tom Cruise film, and no one else in the world can or will make these films. Like, it's kind of fucking incredible. Like, there's a lot of shady shit about Tom Cruise, seemingly.
Oh, yeah.
But fuck me, makes good movies. Like, Jesus yeah. Christ, no one can do this. And I can't remember who... who was it? Someone... It might have been on The Big Picture. Someone was talking about, like, this idea that, like, maybe Tom Cruise, like, half wants to die in a stunt accident to become immortal. Like, yeah. is that part... Like, does he want to be, like, the greatest action star ever by doing the craziest stunt that involves him dying?
You can't imagine, like, an 80-year-old Tom Cruise, can you? Like, he's just not going to stop.
The thing is, I can, because he'd look exactly the same.
Yeah, that's true. He does some good running in this as well. But, yeah, I agree. Like, obviously, he's got some personal stuff that no one... It's really a big, massive, weird mystery, isn't it? But I don't think there's been... Like, I think he's probably the biggest movie star ever. Like, there is no one I... He could be in any film, and I will watch him. Like, even... early on, like some bad films like Cocktail, not a very good film at all, quite a bad film, but he is just so watchable in all of it. Like, I just, yeah, I'd watch him do anything. Yeah, it's weird how he's kind of, yeah, he only makes these big action films now,
yeah,
but they're never less than good. Even like something like Jack Reacher is it's fun, like it's good action, but yeah, I just
got Werner Herzog as a villain, that's just exactly. good shit. Wasn't there something, did we talk about it on here, where like to make the next Mission Impossible, he like paid $250 million or something for a fucking... No, it's not that much money. But he paid like millions and millions of dollars to get a cruise ship so that he could get people into a COVID bubble that was big enough for the... that was big enough for a film set. And you're like, Jesus Christ, man.
He just loves making movies.
He does.
Do you know what, one other film it really reminded me of, and here's is an old reference to people, the 1955 film The Dam Busters. I don't know if anyone's ever seen.
I've never actually watched it.
It's so good, and the music's incredible. But it's very much that sort of thing of like, we've got, and obviously that's based on real life, so it's much more impressive. But yeah, based on that, you know, building up to this one big, almost like seemingly impossible mission with fighter planes and bombers to try and achieve a target. So remind me a lot of that. And Peter Jackson's meant to be remaking that. He's been trying to remake that, I think, for 10 years.
I can remember way before I was even a writer that being a whole thing.
Yeah. I hope he does. I hope this really kicks him into action. But yeah, Top Gun Maverick I thought was absolutely fantastic, and I do want to watch it again, so please be excited for the 25th. Also want to note, because I mentioned it a while ago now, finally, I think today, Everything Everywhere All at Once is out in the UK in cinemas, and again, I can't recommend that enough, because although Top Gun Maverick is a very, very good film, Everything Everywhere All at Once is on another level in terms of film. So Matt, you were lucky enough to see it because you were in America last week.
I was in America last week, and yeah, I got a double whammy of multiverse films. I got the MCU's slightly lackluster version of it, which was Doctor Strange, not so much of a fan of. But Everything Everywhere All at Once is like astonishing. It's not my favourite of the Daniels' two films. Like,
oh,
I'm still
Swiss Army
Man. I'm still a Swiss Army Man, devout.
You just love farts, though. I
watched that for the first time a couple of weeks ago in preparation for this, and, yeah, I mean, that's a fucking good film. I don't understand why disliked it.
I just love Daniel Radcliffe being weird. Like, yeah. On the back of that, we then watched Guns Akimbo, which I hadn't seen and had a wicked time with it, even though it's sort of absolute B-movie trash.
And now he's playing Weird Al.
But yes, anyway, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once is, like, it's magnificent in it's, like, this really thrifty multiverse kind of movie, mm-hmm. which I really love about it. But it's so much heart. That's the thing that comes, like, you go through this really kind of trippy movie and then realize that it's all about discussing, like, emotion mm-hmm. and heart and really getting to the center of, like, family issues and stuff like that. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch it again at some point very soon. It's good we have films because all the games are disappearing from this year. Starfield, Redfall delayed. Mm-hmm. One thing we do have coming though, is it September or October? Gotham Knights.
October 25th, is it?
October. We have Gotham Knights and we saw like a good bit of extended gameplay this week. I feel like a lot of people we're talking about are quite down on it from what they saw. I'm by no means blown away by what I've seen, but I still think it looks very fun to me.
I was trying to work out why I'm excited for this game, and I think it's partly just because I haven't played, like, a good urban open world for ages. Like, loads of people are doing big countrysides, and there's something about, like, big fucking buildings and moody architecture that I'm kind of into. And, yeah, I think I'm quite excited for it. I quite like the idea of just flying about. I went back and read some of the interview questions we did with them when they first announced it, and, like, they really push on the idea that this is like a full open world, like no gating, like beyond like enemy level gating, but even that they said isn't designed to like stop you from going places. So I mean, only because I've played it recently, I promise, but like, you know how you can go anywhere in Elden Ring kind of, but like some places will kick your ass more than others. Like, I think they're going for a bit of that vibe, and like I'm kind of cool with it. Like, I like the idea of having a big bike and a glider and shit. Like, that's
I just like Batman as well.
He's not in it. Well, I mean, he definitely will be.
He will be.
He'll turn up. Dead. He'll be running the Court of Owls.
Yeah. I do get some of the, not necessarily worries, but obviously they showed gameplay of Nightwing and Red Hood. Mm-hmm. The gameplay does look, the combat does look a little stiff, I think, because people are so used to a Batman game being the Arkham combat, which is so smooth and like precise, whereas this did look, you know, it did look a little bit more Avengers like but I don't think that's a fair comparison for the game as a whole, because this is, whereas Avengers just has problems in the way it is built as a game, as to be a live service game, they've gone out of their way so many times to say this is not a live service game, this is a story game you can play in co-op.
Combat
where the fun is.
Built to work online. Like, that's what that is. Like, you can't have fully free-flowing combat in a co-op, like, PvE game in that way, in terms of melee, because the game would not be able to keep up on two sides. So you've got to have... It kind of necessarily has to be a bit clunkier. And, like, your mileage is going to vary on that. I'm personally fine with the idea of it because I want to play this game with someone else, like, all the way through. And I do like this idea that they've kind of pushed down the line of, you know, you could have two players with the same character, but those two characters can be spec'd in very different ways and do different stuff. And, like, all that stuff, like, appeals to me. Just, like, tooling about and having, like, a Batgirl who fucking rockets about and, like, a Robin that's really beefy for some reason. Like, I think it would be quite cool.
Yeah. I'm into it. Before they showed any real gameplay, I was kind of thought, I'm going to play as Red Hood in this game because I think Red Hood is a cool character. But he was the character I watched and I was like, oh, that combat doesn't look great. It looks quite heavy, quite clunky. Just the fact, like, non-lethal bullets. It didn't look like it would feel great to me, whereas Nightwing did look a lot more acrobatic. I don't know, I'm still very much into it. And like I said, like, as long as it's a good Batman kind of story game, I'm going to have a good time with it, I think.
It's picked the right kind of, like, having the Court of Owls as the core. It's something that, like, has not been explored outside of the comics. You know, it's right for pulling on that. I'm going to say this one didn't do a huge amount for me. It's the previous big gameplay one they did that has got all the stuff in that I'm interested in. Like, I love that idea that the whole, you know, when they were showing the Mr. Freeze battle and there was that idea of kind of, like, there might be a slightly nemesis-y side of this game, regardless of whether it's got a full nemesis-style system or not. But the idea that, you know, coming back against Mr. Freeze's kind of, like, minions and him himself might change over time and stuff like that. that's the sort of stuff that I'm interested in. This looks a little bit too kind of like slightly MOBA influenced on the combat for my personal preference, but as you say, Joe, like, I'm looking to play this through with someone, and being able to have that Bat Family arrangement, which is something that no film or game has ever given me, is what I want out of this.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it still, I think. Yeah, maybe it's just us being a little bubble and people being a bit snarky. But then again, if you follow a lot of games people on Twitter, you will just see a lot of snark. So, you know, that's what you're going to get from people. So,
I just subtweeting the entire industry there.
Exactly, yeah. You know, 90% of it. You know, there's some good ones out there. But there we go. Why don't we talk about a game you can play now, I believe. Is that correct, Matt? There's some more Warhammer on the go. Tell us about the new Warhammer game.
There is. New Warhammer game, Chaos Gate Demon Hunters, is a... I was about to say spiritual sequel, but technically I guess it is a sequel to Chaos Gate, a strategy game that came out when I was very young. But this is basically, it's an XCOM game, but with a Warhammer skin. Which kind of puts it down, but it's not. It's genuinely very, very good, which is why I'm here to talk about it. So this is very much kind of like in the Firaxis XCOM vein. You have a small collection of troops in turn-based kind of tactics environments, and then there is a strategy layer where you have a home base that you get to make improvements to that ultimately changes the way that you can play. The difference between XCOM and this is that your troops are Grey Knight Space Marines, which are basically psychic warrior monks that are like 9 feet tall, encased in ceramite power armor, huge force nemesis weapons. Yeah, this is very much me. I was at Warhammer World on the day that they launched the original Grey Knight sort of miniatures, which would have been when I was like maybe 13. So I can remember buying Grey Knight models like the day they came out. So I've got like quite a love for this side of the Warhammer lore, and they are really fun because kind of like they've got essentially giant double-barreled machine guns mounted to their arms that fire sort of psychically imbued bullets that explode on impact. So they are, whereas kind of XCOM, you start off with very kind of weedy troops that gradually kind of build over time to use kind of all sorts of alien weapons that you get that really cool power curve. You start really fucking powerful in Chaos Gate because you've got these incredible sort of soldiers, but you only take in like 4, I think it upgrades to 5 later on, but you take in 4 of them against what is basically hordes of enemies, because your enemy in this game is the Chaos faction of Nurgle. So basically God of Plague and Disease, creating a giant plague that's running across the galaxy, which you are here to stop in the way that, like, in XCOM, you're there to stop an alien invasion. This is you preventing a plague spreading through a solar system. And at the start of the game, there are lots of just kind of little zombie sort of things that you're fighting, which are great because you can smash them up in a, you know, a single turn. You're smashing them, but gradually that plague begins to bloom and spread, and you get the traitor legions, which are basically you, but evil. So suddenly that's how like the tactics change up. You're going up against other essentially walking tanks that you need to kind of work with. And that's all very, very XCOM. But what it's got is this kind of system. There are little layers of systems that are on top, which is A, there's the plague is spreading through every turn that you do. So gradually kind of like all the enemies that you've killed can come back to life because the plague kind of reinfects their corpses and they get reanimated. So the way that you take your turns becomes more and more kind of like increasingly pressured because you're like, oh, I need to ideally complete objectives very, very quickly in order to prevent this plague spreading throughout kind of like the zone that I'm in. And that's kind of cool because I'd normally play kind of like XCOM reasonably kind of like restrained in that kind of like you use your half turns to move your troops up and scout out and try and figure out what's going on. Using like half a turn in Chaos Gate Demon Hunters is you're wasting a lot of time by being cautious. You really need to kind of storm in there and defeat kind of like your enemies. And then on top of that, you've also got all of your warriors are kind of psychic. So they can have standard attacks or they can start using kind of like, I can use psychic abilities to make my damage do twice as much as it normally would do. But each time you do that, you to get very nerdy and very in the lore, your psychic powers come from the warp, which is where chaos originally comes from, who are the people that you're fighting. So each time you use it, it ticks up a warp meter. And basically, and the warp meter is ticking up anyway, but each time you do a psychic attack, it increases that exponentially. Mm-hmm. And so the more psychic attacks you use, the more potential you've got for this warp interference to happen, which causes like randomized events to happen in the session. So for example, like one of your characters might get covered in goo. That means that they can only walk half as much as they could before, and sort of different debuffs like that, or it might summon in other stuff. So it's a very kind of pressured sort of turn-based tactics environment, which I really like. It means that it is a lot more challenging than I ever thought it would be, because like XCOM is about the level for me, for like standard level XCOM.
Yeah, and that's not easy either.
But like I've played enough of XCOM now to be able to get through those. This is harder than XCOM because you have got like, if one thing goes wrong, like a match will, well, a session will very quickly spiral and you'll find like, oh, they're opening warp gates all over the place and now there's another 15 zombies on the map. And they're very easy to take down, but you can get very easily get mobbed. Luckily, your characters can die like 3 times. So if they die in a match, because they are super soldiers, you can bring them back into the next mission.
So it's not as harsh as XCOM.
Yeah, you don't have instant death, which can be a problem. And also you've got kind of like, you have apothecary units, which are the ones that can go out, they can heal, and they've got kind of like these skulls that they can send across the map and they can heal other characters. So there's a lot of counter kind of units that you've got and counter abilities to go against the pressure. But along the sides of having all of that, you know, it's got the classic, like, you know, the Overwatch abilities that you get in XCOM, which allow you to lock down kind of an area and have a gun sighted. So anybody that walks across. Demon Hunters is a lot more kind of urban inside in its map design. So there's a lot more choke points than I think I've ever found that there are in XCOM. So, for example, like a lot more big bulkhead doorways, which you do get very, very cool, like moments where you can run at that door and you can kick it down. But if there are then like 4 enemies on the other side that then set up Overwatch, it's like, well, how do I funnel my way in here? Benefit of that is a lot more destructible terrain. It's not full destructible maps, but more than there was in XCOM. And the really nice thing about it is that you can do stuff like a lot of, because it's a very gothic sort of setting, that, you know, kind of like big gothic kind of statues and sort of like, you know, heirlooms to the Empire and stuff like that, you can just go and kick them over and just knock them onto groups of enemies. So you get like really cool, okay, I can use the environment sort of tactically. So it's got all that kind of stuff. And
sounds
then
like there's a lot going on in this
it sounds
stressful as fuck.
it's really fun because obviously everything about it is incredibly OTT, as the Warhammer universe is. It's like massive kind of men in huge armor shooting bullets the size of milk bottles, and like it's got the sense of humor that Warhammer's got. Like the chaos minions are like absolutely batshit bonkers, and then when you get like a good grenade kill, like it absolutely catapults like 7 pieces of them across the map and stuff like that.
Yeah, another game where we're trying to kill chaos this year.
Gotta kill chaos.
I mean Warhammer really was the first thing where chaos was being killed.
They kicked off the chaos killing. So like obviously this is a Warhammer game, but if you're not into Warhammer such as myself, it's still fundamentally a very good game.
There's very little need to kind of know anything going in. Like it very much treats you, because in the base layers, very much like XCOM, you've got different characters that talk to you. Your Grandmaster is played by Andy Serkis.
Yes, please.
Well, I'm into it now.
And
the natural follow-up to Jason Isaacs appearing, you've got to have a venerable British actor. Absolutely. In your Warhammer game. That's the deal. By the way, sorry if you can hear what sounds like a big fly. There's a big fly in my room.
I can't hear it. I'm going to listen for it now, though.
But yeah, kind of like all of those characters will, I've noticed, kind of talk to you as if you're not necessarily like in understanding of what the Warhammer universe is. They'll explain to you kind of like what the Grey Knights are.
I just love the idea of exposition between Grey Knights. Like, I've just got to put on my Terminator armor, which is made up of Oh no, my poison gland has started overreacting. Yeah, Space Marines have poison glands, Cardi. Get used to it.
They're acid. Okay,
yeah, I love it.
Yeah, like this, the way that the game kind of kicks off is you've been doing kind of this mission against a completely other Chaos faction. You're fighting against Khorne at the start, and you get pulled over by the Inquisition basically on your ship, and an Inquisitor comes on board and is like, you belong to me now, and I'm telling you what our new missions are and what our new crusade is. And, you know, for someone like me that knows kind of the Warhammer, I understand how the Inquisition relates to the Grey Knights. The Grey Knights are the chamber militant of the Malleus section of the
Imperium. I'm into it.
But if you don't know that, all of those kind of connections are explained by the characters in the game, who are, like, it's definitely, like, B-tier budget, but B-tier budget for a Warhammer game is, like, very, very high. We just don't get AAA development.
Yeah. It's a treat for you, is what it's saying. Yeah, I can tell you're very excited. I'm happy for you that, you know, this is making your day.
It's basically the best XCOM game since Gears Tactics.
Oh, well, there we go. That's all you needed to say. There we go. I do like a good XCOM game every now and then. And you know what? I still haven't properly got into Gears Tactics, so I might do that one first. Is Warhammer 40k only on PC at the moment?
It is, yes. But I did notice that it has controller support, and that suggests to me it's like, oh, okay, there's ambitions to... I imagine it's one of those, like, if it sells well enough on PC, then we'd consider, like, doing the port job. So yes, like, obviously XCOM can be very easily played on a controller, so I would say the exact same for this.
There we go. Very exciting. If you're into need some new XCOM in your life, check out, what is it again, Warhammer 40k, Chaos Gate Demon Hunters. Yes. I got it right. I was making up one nugget, actually accidentally got it right.
Yeah,
so there we go.
I know our review made the joke of it's yet another in the series of Warhammer games that demand three titles, because they all seem to need three titles. I'm not a fan of the amount of fucking words, but the game is good.
Well, there we go. And that's all that really matters. I've been also playing a new game, and it's time yet again for this week's Action Roguelike, because every week there's a new one. Except this one did come out about 2 weeks ago, so, you know, I'm kind of cheating a little bit. But I've been playing a bit of Rogue Legacy 2. I've only played a little bit so far, but I can already feel those hooks getting in me. Like, I loved the original Rogue Legacy. That was
so
really
good.
The first roguelike I remember playing. It felt like the one that really broke through a bit. And yeah, I love that one so much. And with this one, you're just kind of getting more of that, and that's what I want. It's like everything from that first one, but even more added. And like, if you don't know, like, kind of how Rogue Legacy works, you go through each randomly generated level, and you get as far as you can each time, collecting as much gold as you can, and you will inevitably die. And sometimes early on in the game, it's best to just try and move around as fast as you can, collect as much gold as you can, die, and then upgrade at the end of each run. But the twist on it is that it kind of has the humour of a lot, a good sense of humour, which some games struggle to get right. But so every time you die, you get reborn as the next descendant in this family, and you pick one of three builds every time, and they have different perks, different classes, different weapons you unlock. But that's where some of the humour comes into it, that some of those traits are just ridiculous. Like, I've got a couple of them here. Like, one trait is just the pacifist trait, which kind of overrules every other ability that character has, whereas they cannot attack any characters in the map. They are not allowed to attack. But the bonus of that is the amount of gold you get from objects is vastly increased on that run. So basically, you want to, if you pick that character, you're basically just rolling into pots and like cupboards.
It's just like a
gold.
Death run.
Yeah, dodging, like, yeah, hooning around, dodging as much as you can. You can't kill anything until you die, basically trying to collect as much gold. There's the IBS trait, which means that sometimes you fart when you jump or dash, and if you time that right near enemies, you can give them a burn effect. There's also a good one called the Diva Air, and the Divas, what happens is they get a 50% gold increase, but the entire screen will be black except for a number of spotlights that highlight you, all the enemies, and projectiles, and it will remain that way until that room is cleared. So it's kind of high risk reward. And then once you do clear a room, you're showered with like flowers and applause because you're a diva. They just have the fun way of like blending fun little gameplay quirks with actual humor. Like there's just so much charm to these games, and crucially, it's just so much fun. Like if you loved the original Rogue Legacy, you're gonna love this one, I think, just because it's more of what made that original one great. Did you guys play a lot of the first one?
I've never played a second of it.
I played it when it first came out. It was great. I found it incredibly difficult.
Really?
I was really bad at it.
I never... Maybe it's just my memory letting me down, but I never found it quite as hard as, like, a Dead Cells or, like, a Hades or anything. I found it a little bit more forgiving than that. But I think also part of this one is because you get upgrades and rewards so quickly. Like, dying after 2 minutes never feels like... There is definitely that one more run element to it. Like, it never feels like a letdown if you die after 30 seconds in this one. Like, don't go into it expecting, like, a Hades, like, level story or anything. That's not what these games are about. It's about the fun of it and the humour of it. But, yeah, I think you'd enjoy it quite a bit, Matt, if you gave it a go. It's on PC and Xbox. It's been in early access for a while, but it was the 1.0 release was last week or the week before. But I believe we gave it a 9 out of 10, which... From the very little I've played so far, I could see why. But yeah, very addictive. Give Rogue Legacy a go. I think it's on sale still. I think it's only like £15 or something. So yeah, definitely check out Rogue Legacy 2. You two have been playing a game which I think a lot of people will never have heard of, but I have been keeping my eye on and are definitely going to jump in this weekend. Tell us about Citizen Sleeper.
Okay. It's by a guy called Gareth, who the rest of his name I don't remember. And he previously did this game called In Other Waters, which was fucking beautiful. But ultimately, I found a little bit dull. Which was a game, basically, the two things these two games have in common, and I think that that this developer really enjoys, is A, like, a gorgeous... approach to like UI. So the game is as much about how you're navigating the screen as like the world you're in to some extent. Like in Other Waters, you played an AI in someone's like futuristic wetsuit as they tried to collect stuff from an alien ocean. And so everything was presented from the AI's point of view, and it was like this amazing like cyan and yellow color scheme and stuff. And in this one, Citizen Sleeper is a game in which you are essentially effectively like a replicant from Blade Runner, although not in any way human looking. You are very clearly a robot, but you have had a human consciousness implanted into you as part of this like weird corporate gig that your human has gone. It's quite Severance in a way, actually, because it is about these. Consciousness is put in robots and forced to work for a horrific future or corporation, effectively against their will, and they know that their memories are emulated, so they know that the original person is out there somewhere, and you are the sleeper of the name. Your character escapes from this horrific corporate gig and ends up crash landing or landing somehow on effectively a station outside of like the control of law or corporations seems to be more the point. This is very much like corporations are governments and vice versa. And so initially all it is a text adventure about this robot person waking up and going, what the hell do I do now that I'm free? While also knowing that they are built with a planned obsolescence. So the game has kind of three different systems that all come together. One, it is a fairly straightforward visual novel or text adventure type thing. You talk to people. The bulk of the game is delivered in text on screen. Two, it's a survival game. Every day within the game, you are your condition is ticking down, and you have two different bars: one for your like body falling apart, one for your hunger. And when your hunger is down, your body falls apart quicker. And one for your daily action points. And it's that I think sets it apart, because it effectively plays like Persona's daytime moments.
Yes, please.
So you have a set of actions per day. depending on how high your condition is. And those actions are also determined by a number of dice rolls that are made each day that mean you can do well or badly at your actions for that day. So you have to choose which dice to put into which decisions each day. If this all sounds complicated, it really isn't. Like, because the UI is so beautifully presented, like, everything looks perfect. You're given the information you need at all times. It just, like, it really, like, sings as an interactive experience in that way.
I really want to get around to playing it, because I spoke to you, like, I've been reading about it, and the words that pop out to me were, you've already said one, which is Blade Runner, and then I also saw someone comparing it a bit to Disco Elysium.
I want to jump in that. Yeah. I don't think it's anything fucking Disco Elysium.
I think in its politics it is. In the message it's trying to get across, it has Disco Elysium, but in the gameplay it definitely isn't.
Yeah, because okay. I originally saw it as, like, it's Disco Elysium for Cyberpunk, and that was the first thing that put me onto it, and now I've played it. It's not about, like, at least certainly the, I think of, how long is it, Joe? Because you finished it.
I did it in about 4 or 5 hours.
Okay, so I'd say I'm probably about, like, a quarter to a third of the way through it. And so far it doesn't feel like, it's not about building your person, is it? No. In the same way that Disco is.
So I did see it described a bit as like a, yeah, build like a character-based RPG in a way.
No, so no. It has the trappings of one. You choose a character class at the start and they get, like, bonuses in certain areas and minuses in certain other areas.
Okay.
I think the thing to go in with here is treat this like an interestingly presented visual novel before anything else. It is not a game about branching narratives. It's not a game about stats and min-maxing or anything like that. By the end of the game, you will have almost full stats across everything if you do everything you want to. And you will also meet and do something with almost every character with almost nothing being locked off. It's really not designed to, like, be a sort of roguelike or replayable thing. Like, it has a story it wants to tell, and there are, like, 9 different endings, but you can also, without giving too much away, you can get, like, 3 of those endings in one playthrough by doing certain things, which is what I did. And This is kind of what I want to get across. Like, this is first and foremost, like, a really interesting and very often, like, beautiful story. Because all that first bit where I'm describing, like, consciousness, implanted, horrific corporations, all this stuff, all of this is a dystopian backdrop. But the thing I really loved about this game is that it's a story about people doing the best they can in a dystopia. Like, almost everyone you meet effectively is a good person and wants to help, and the game is about doing well by helping people. And I know that some people will immediately be like, woke bullshit, but it's actually just, like, it's a really positive science fiction story about living in a bad place. And it was super refreshing to play one of these games, come in and be like, oh, I'm gonna be miserable with this story for so long, and actually it does everything it can to, like, place, like, hope in misery and, like, light amongst dark. And there are genuinely, like, gorgeous bits of writing in here. There's a section where you meet a cat and it just describes the life of this cat on a space station in the most lovely way for no reason. Like, the cat is not narratively significant, and I was just sitting there being like, I feel like crying about this cat's lovely life. Like, it was so nice. And so much of it is about just, like, working to help people and people helping you in return. And it doesn't beat you over the head with its politics. It's not, like, it is not a political game in, like, the traditional sense. But it has a viewpoint and it has a worldview that it's trying to get across to you. And every ending feels to me, or at least the endings I got, feel to me like versions of that same message presented in different ways. And what I effectively was choosing in the end is, like, where do I feel like I would do the most help by ending this game in this place, rather than where do I want the story to go? Where do, you know, like, you kind of grow attached to these characters. I think it's really special and really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things in terms of the writing that I think, like, sort of almost beautifully kicks it off is at the start you're asked, what are you doing? And, like, one of the options is, I just want to build a life, and that's what I chose. And that idea of kind of, like, it's not just survival against all costs, but it's trying to make something of the time that you've been given, especially for a character that has been told from the start that they're on a ticking clock.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that I think is really nice. The other thing is that from my perspective is that, very, very clear the sort of tabletop RPGs that this guy loves to play, because, the one that I play that uses a lot of these systems is a game called Blades in the Dark, but it uses a lot of simplistic tabletop stuff that is very much kind of like the antithesis to D&D, whereas D&D is a very heavy kind of stats focused thing. There are a lot of RPG games that were just like, nah, screw all the stats. What we're going to do is just have a dice and you roll it. If you get high numbers on the dice, you've done really well. If you get middle numbers, you've done okay. And if you get bottom numbers, you've done shit and something bad's going to happen to you. Mm. And the way that it uses that, and it also uses the clock systems, which I've used in several tabletop RPGs as well, which is where kind of like you have like these day to day, you've got these little interactions. So it's like, you've been to the doctor today and she says to you, I can actually get you some syringes that are going to help you, sort of like deal with the fact that your body is designed to reject all its organs and kill you off to make sure that you're obsolete. And you're like, she's like, I can't help you now, but I will help you. And then you kind of have to go off and do things as her clock fills over time. So it creates all of these things that you actually have relationships that are developing over. It's not just within the specific instance that you're talking to someone. There are physical kind of things on screen that are saying, over time, you know, if you come back to this guy that's selling you mushrooms and you come back to him four times over four different days, he's going to eventually kind of open up to you and there's going to be new kind of things you can find.
He's also my favorite character. I fucking love Emphis. He's so nice.
And then kind of like just seeing like, oh, there's this kind of like trading dock over here, but I can physically see a meter building up over time. And I know that if I come here once this is full, I can look at what's at the trading dock and maybe find something that helps me out. And all of these, it's a very, as you say, it's a very UI physical game because there's no physical characters in a world on screen. It's a map, right? Essentially, is what you're exploring with. When you go and speak to these characters, you literally just get a visual representation, like a nice bit of artwork.
It's really nice artwork as well. Like really nice
again,
artwork.
Reminds me a lot of like the art that you would see. If this was a tabletop RPG, that would be the art that would be on their character page in the book. Mm-hmm. Like, does so much with so little in such an admirable way.
The only thing I would say about the clock system is that at the tail end of the game, that's the only time where the UI stuff starts coming apart, because you start getting on clocks for things where it's kind of the only thing you have left to do. Mm-hmm. And so you're ending up like doing effectively just, there was a couple of points where I had to effectively like start and end a day six times to just do the next thing in there. And the only other part, so I'm playing on Switch. I will say Switch has some really bad performance issues. Like, for quite a simple game, like I plugged it into a dock and it absolutely freaked out and I had to restart the game. Like, it doesn't really deal. So I would play this on PC if you can, but by the end, particularly on Switch, like so the map, it's essentially a kind of half a Halo ring to some extent. Like, you open the map up by going along that ring, and by the end you're having to do stuff at two ends of the ring that requires you to like go all the way down, do an interaction, move to the next bit of the ring, go all the way down again, start that thing, then move all the way back. And it gets a little bit, like, tedious, kind of busy work at the very end, which kind of ended up being my only irritation with it to some extent. I will also say, like, I know we've done a lot about, like, the message and the niceness and all that stuff. It's also just a really cool sci-fi universe he's built. Like, it's really interesting. Like, there's a lot of stuff you recognize, but the interactions and, like, the implied history of this ring that you're on becomes more and more interesting. There's a whole system we haven't discussed, which is like you can switch from the physical reality of the ring to a mode where you're seeing like the computer systems underneath it, and your character can interact with like AIs underneath or like hack into people's stuff to get certain like upgrades and things like that. It's got a really neat, like, sci-fi worldview at the same time as trying to tell quite a human story at the same time. It's very, very cool.
I'm into it. I'm definitely going to check it out.
It's on Game Pass as well, which is
really, I forgot about that. Yeah,
and only 4 to 5 hours. Citizen Sleeper, that's what it's called. If you missed that,
banger.
Check it out. You might enjoy it, especially if you have Game Pass. Why not check it out? We're going to put out a little call out now, because I think it'll be us three if we do it. We've all finished Elden Ring now, which I think if you told, especially me and Joe, that a few months ago, we would have laughed at you.
Yeah.
But and you've pretty much done everything in it as well. You've scraped it all,
rinsed that bad boy.
Exactly. So we're thinking of doing a little like one-off little special spoiler cast of Elden Ring. But mainly we want to know: A, is there an appetite for that? So let us know. And B, do you have any questions you'd like to ask us? We'll go through quite a few questions on it and probably center the episode around that. So IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com if you want to know, I don't know, how we played the game, or if you have any questions about, anything about the game, really.
Any lore questions? Pretty much a lore expert these days.
We know everything now.
I know all sorts of shit about Radagon and the Outer Gods. It's pretty good stuff.
Let me tell you about the ring. All of that. If you want to, any questions about Elden Ring? Because that's,
and if you're not bothered,
it's the biggest game of the year now.
Don't worry about it. I don't think we'll do it as like a full numbered episode. We'll do it as an extra special, so you don't have to listen to it. Promise.
Next Friday there will be an episode that probably doesn't involve any Elden Ring.
We're not saying when we're going to do this either. All right, don't tie us in.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's coming. It'll come when it's ready. Yeah. Like all great things in this world, like the Ember Search. Inside, it's the UK IGN crew. Yeah, and ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Hold tight, the DJ, we coming through. Yeah, and ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Is it Endless Search? Right, this week's Endless Search comes courtesy of Scott Seal, who sent in, I'm going to say, borderline angry email, Scott, about the Endless Search last week. I'm only joking. Basically, I don't know if either of you listened to last week's episode of the podcast. We're playing last week's game. But basically, Scott wrote in to say, and the subject line here of his email was, stolen Endless Search.
Uh-oh.
Says, hey team, sorry for the dramatic subject line. I was listening this week and couldn't help but notice the Endless Search game you played was the exact same submission I sent in quite a while ago, called PG Tits instead of PG Tips. It's actually, he's corrected that to say it was called something else, but I'm not going to say that because it's a bit ruder and I don't want to say that word, frankly. But anyway. Well, Scott goes on to say, I realised there was no way of the sender knowing my game. I was just disappointed you hadn't played my version. Perhaps the other guys was delivered a little better. No worries, Scott. We're going to play it now, though. And I tell you, it probably wasn't because it was written better. It's probably because we literally saw that one first. And sometimes we get lost in the email inbox. But we're playing it now, Scott, so do not fear. So, if you don't know what this game was, which it sounds like neither of you will, basically, what we do here is we take one-star reviews on IMDb films, but these are all good films, so these are user one-star reviews of generally good films, and basically we're going to go through clues of each of those. You get, I think, you get 10 points here if you get it on the first clue, then 8, 6, 4, and 2 as the clues get a bit easier. Mm-hmm. And basically these are mad reviews of films with people with, frankly, borderline, I don't know, just ridiculous opinions. I'm gonna put it out there. But there you go. So, bear that in mind. Bad reviews for generally good films. Let's get going. Film number one. So this is the first section of this the ones. Well, I think these are actually different from different one star reviews, not necessarily from the same review. So bear that in mind. Clue number one. I kept waiting for there to be one redeeming quality about this movie. One character that was remotely interesting. Never happened. The music was truly bizarre, misplaced. Maybe if you want to examine the mind of a complete psychopath without the benefit of a writer who even understands how to present that, give it a shot.
Is this There Will Be Blood?
It is. Wow, 10 points for Matt.
It was the music that gave it away.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
Ah, well, there you go. 10 points straight off the bat there. I'll read the other clues just because they're funny. I swear I try to like this movie, but it's just depressing, boring, sometimes even demented movie. Some great actors
Something can't be boring and demented. That does not make sense.
Look, these are all bad reviews. Some great actors here, but the silent first 15-20 minutes to the total lack of pace, disconnected soundtrack, and lack of glue to join all the pieces together in an attractive manner, this movie was a total mess. A lecture about greediness, selfishness, and religion, told in a very heavy, dark, slow-paced, and boring way.
All of that was kind of correct until they said boring.
And not mess. But,
There we go. I meant the bit about a lecture onwards.
Some of these are quite long. I'm not going to read them all because you got it early. But, you know, they're all wrong, is what we're saying about that film. I think someone once actually wrote in to claim I was lying that There Will Be Blood was my favourite film. I'm not lying. It's generally considered a masterpiece. But there you go.
Lying.
Yeah, I'm just pretending I like that film for my own benefit.
I love the idea of someone being like, what's your favourite film? Oh, it's Citizen Kane. You liar!
You liar.
What a weird response to an opinion.
Unless you've never seen the film, then you're a liar. Right, funny. Okay. Here's film number two. And the first clue. Music over the top. Acting non-existent. Length felt like 6 hours. And not in a good way. As people left the theatre, I saw shaking heads. Don't understand people raving about it. They must be connected to the film somehow. Save your money, watch the original, and don't let this ruin it.
Interesting.
Like it
for me. Interesting.
Is it Blade Runner 2049?
It is.
Fucking hell.
That's 20-0.
I was going to say Suspiria.
Oh, well, that knows. Have you written these?
No, I genuinely swear I have not. Like, I, having been in America for a week, I have not opened the inbox for.
No, I'm saying, did you write these reviews?
I did not. No.
Let me see. Is there any other funny ones here? Movie is too long. Story's way too simple. A bit of everything while not successful in any part of it. Using CGI in sex part. How is that relevant to the story? Sony logo is everywhere.
There's one bit, right? Ana de Armas, in the whole movie, normal size. One bit, she's massive. What's going on?
I've got to read this review because this is funny. This is the way it starts. I personally have over 500 DVDs in my collection, of which over 50 are from the sci-fi genre.
What?
I don't know what the Kool-Aid reviewers have been drinking, but this was one of the most tedious, pretentious, boring, meaningless, poorly acted, loudest, dumbest movies I've ever experienced.
You're sincerely a broken fucking replicant.
Right, let's go on to the next one.
Cells film interlinked.
film number three. God, this is a long one. This movie is one of the worst I've ever seen. It was really hard to sit through and pay attention to the whole time.
Any guesses yet, Matt? You probably got it.
It was so boring, and the fact that they're British doesn't help.
Oh, hello.
The lighting for the movie is also really bad. It was also unnecessarily gross and bloody in one part.
Guess? Can I guess?
I did.
I'm going to say The Witch.
It's not.
Oh.
I'm not locking you out there. You can guess okay. Many times you offer. I did laugh in a couple of parts, but I think it was pure luck on the writer's part.
What's that mean?
Having the characters so absent-minded was not funny, and I usually like stupid characters. I'm a huge fan of Jim Carrey, but this movie didn't pull through for me. I recommend this video not be viewed.
Is it Hot Fuzz?
It is.
Fucking hell. Bloody 30
nil,
one
like
part.
Gory.
30-0.
I swear to fucking God I've not read any of these.
I believe you.
Yeah, that's good going.
You just see through the matrix of fucking boring dickheads on the internet.
It's because I've been playing Citizen Sleeper and I've been hacking into the Matrix.
That's it.
Trying to see if there are any other funnier comments here. The cast reads like a who's who of British acting talent. Sadly, you see very little of most of them. Bill Nye must have had no more than 6 lines, and Martin Freeman and Steve Coogan even less. A truly bad cinematic experience.
That's it.
There you go, 30-0. So Matt, you have one, but we've still got two more films here. That's the first clue here might give it away, but who knows? Okay, this is just the first one. This is all it says. It sucked. This is all in caps, by the way. It sucked when he killed that bird on top the roof. Was very disturbing to see.
Do we say these are all reckoned to be good films generally?
Yeah, I'd say these are all good films.
When he killed a bird on the roof.
I'm guessing he means killed a woman on a roof. Unless it is literally just him slamming a pigeon.
I'm thinking
it's not much grammar here. It sucked when he killed that bird on top of roof. Was very disturbing to see.
Is it The Lighthouse?
It is The Lighthouse.
Hey!
There we go.
It is an actual
sequel. It's not
sequel.
Really on a roof.
It's not on
it's
a roof.
It's on a well.
Yeah.
That's the opposite of a roof.
Let me see if there's already other fun. this is a fun review. This would have given it away. This is the second to last one. As an avid Lighthouse lover, I had to see this one.
Jesus.
But I'm sorry I did. It's the most terrible movie I've ever watched. Nothing horror in this movie except the movie itself. Very difficult movie. Very black. Very dark. Very depressing. It's an avid Lighthouse lover.
Monkey pump!
You've all got these on the first. We've not got to a second clue yet. It's very impressive.
Just a couple of real film buffs here. Yeah, doing some film buffery.
Exactly. I do like this game. It's fun, though, just to read other people's madness.
Yeah.
All right, here's the last one.
I mean, a lot of people would agree with The Lighthouse not being good.
Yeah,
disagree.
That's split.
But that's just like me. It. I'm just a kooky guy.
I like it. Don't love it. I wouldn't give it one star, though. Right, here's the last one star film reviews. I was well prepared to like this movie on the basis of the art alone, and the art did not disappoint. However, still giving it one star. Right. However, I found much of the humour to be based on cruelty, and I was truly horrified by the overall message of the film.
Oh.
And here's what they think the message of the film is. Lower your expectations for yourself and everything will work out fine. This is just so wrong. Inspire your children to be good and strong and true, and which predates this shallow and uninspiring vehicle. It's, you know, some not badly written, but, you know, some madness still nonetheless.
Lower your... What was the message? Lower your expectations?
The message of the film, they think, is, yeah, lower your expectations for yourself and everything will work out fine.
Toy Story 2.
I think it's just Toy Story. I'm going to give it to you.
Okay.
Because, I'm not going to lie, Scott didn't actually put the name of the film for this one. Didn't give me the answer, but from the last clue, I worked out that it's probably just Toy Story.
Interesting.
But there you go.
30-20. Not too unhappy with that.
No, that's high scoring from both of you there. But, yeah, there
5, 10 out of 10 answers. Feels like this quiz needs some tweaking.
Yeah. I mean, it was much more competitive last week. Maybe, yeah. That's why we didn't read out Scott, because it was too easy.
No, don't throw this back at Scott. Scott was nice.
I'm only joking. But I do like that game. I think we will play it again sometime. Maybe, you know, a fun one to do with games as well, because people have always have mad opinions about everything, because that's the world we live in.
That's
isn't
opinions,
it? A fun
baby.
One. Exactly. And no one's wrong, except all the people that wrote those reviews.
Except everyone who disagrees with you on There Will Be Blood.
Exactly. Categorically incorrect. Let's get on to your feedback, which you can always send to IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. Matt.
Yes, got one from Oliver Ford, who says, "Hello, Cardi and Co." Which is apparently what we are these days.
Should we rename the podcast?
Nope.
God. I've been listening to the podcast for maybe a year now, and before I ask my question, I have to confess, I don't know what the endless search is. What does it mean? What are you searching for? I don't even know why we respect the sea, but at least I can understand. What are you hiding? So I think we should address this before we get to the actual question.
Years ago, there was a man on this podcast called Gav, and he had one game that we would play every week, which was called Keyword Countdown. It's a really good game. And when he left, we set up the endless search for a game that would be worth replacing Keyword Countdown with. we've actually found probably about four games that we just go back to every time. Yeah. But yeah, that's why it's called The Endless Search. It is the endless search for a game to replace Keyword Countdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
There's been some discussion about whether we cut the games between people on the podcast.
I feel like we're not necessarily going to do it every week now. I feel like, you know, when we have a bumper week stuff to talk about, maybe we won't do it.
Playing games.
Exactly. And, you know.
And it's got an amazing theme tune. Exactly. By Code Marla. Was it Code Marla?
Yeah. Exactly. In regards to why do we respect the sea, it's because you don't want to drown.
Yeah. Go back and listen to the drowning special.
Yeah.
Real thing that we did for jobs.
A reminder, I feel like we maybe have reached the bottom of this barrel, but any more grave digging stories,
have we read them
we
all
will
out?
Welcome them. No, because we said we might save them for a grave digging special.
I think we've probably done enough for a grave digging special, but maybe we have enough for a grave digging feedback section special where we like six of them.
I feel like we've got like five or six in the back pocket. So yeah.
I guess there is a big need for grave digging. You just don't think about it.
No, well, you know, it's one business you think that's never really going to... I think we talked about it.
It's recession-proof, baby. Yeah. If anything, it's recession forward.
Until we run out of land.
Yeah.
Once we run out of land, we're fucked.
Exactly. Anyway, I feel like Oliver had more of his email.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So back to Oliver, who says... My question is about old games. I've been playing Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, a game that came out in 2003, for the first time ever thanks to it coming to Switch, and I've been loving it. Are there any old games that you have played for the first time recently that have impressed you? Thanks for the podcast, and respect the sea. Oliver, or Darth Revelo, if you want my Knights of the Old Republic name.
I'd love to know why.
Playing the dark side.
Oh, Revelo is Oliver backwards. That's clever. That sounded like I was being sarcastic. That's genuinely clever. I like doing that for a Star Wars name. I think I talked about it on the podcast, but 40K Space Marine I played for the first time recently. Hmm. That game holds up. Jesus, good stuff. Well done, Jason Isaacs.
It's not really that old, but last couple of weeks I played A Plague Tale Innocence for the first time. It's only like 2 years old, isn't it?
Barely, I never finished that.
It's good. It's wild.
The ending is wild. Yeah, I would
absolutely bonkers.
I'm really looking forward to that sequel now because that is a very, very good game. Apart from one particular section involving a cart, which was atrocious, and basically, if I was reviewing that game, it would have taken it down a whole score. It was so bad. It was the whole game is not difficult. And then that one section took me over half an hour. So I kept failing. It's not good. Apart from that, very, very good game. Really good story. And yeah, nice mix of puzzle, combat and stealth. I really liked it.
I think the problem for us is like we often have to be playing the next thing. So I don't get a lot of chances to look back.
Over Christmas, I did play Fable 2 for the first time and really enjoyed it. That's one. Not for the first time, but I have been playing the original Max Payne through again. And those games still hold up.
Oh,
they're still fantastic.
Just wonderful things. Love them.
Yeah.
Max Payne 1's way harder than you remember when you go back to it.
Oh, yeah. I'm about halfway through at the moment. I'm on the section where you just have to start with a baseball bat. It's a lot harder than I remember. Actually, just trying to balance on those thin red lines in the dream sequence is quite hard. And jumping between, I was like, God, this is, you know, can't wait for those remakes, is what I'm saying. But yeah, still amazing games.
I've not played, again, like you were saying, Joe, like you're so pressured sort of by the job to be playing what's new. Mm. I've been playing the original Monkey Islands just
Have
as
you?
A prep work. Yeah, so I'm about halfway through. Me and my partner are playing them. She's never played them before, so I guess we should probably ask her what her opinion of them are, but she seems to be enjoying them. But halfway through the second one at the moment, and they still obviously stand up because the humour is second to none.
Yeah, because they don't rely on anything apart from humour and good puzzles. Like, those games will never age.
The playing them again, the puzzles in the first one I think are more obvious to work out because it's all on one island. You're either on Scab Island or Monkey Island, and it's like, okay, what I need is on this island, whereas when you go to Monkey Island 2 and the map grows bigger and you've got Scab Island, Fat Island. Fat Island has a little, like, island off the coast of it, and Booty Island. It's then a case of, like, the puzzles are very much not isolated to the island you're on. The solution to the puzzle you're facing on Booty Island might actually be on Scab Island. So it's a little bit more like obtuse in Monkey Island 2, but I love the storyline and I love the humor of 2, so it still holds up as one of my faves.
They're so good. I've got them on my to replay list as well, just because I'm so excited for the new one. Too excited, some may say. Why don't you let us know, IGN_UKFeedback@IGN.com, if there's any old games. Let's say, I'm going to say they have to be at least 10 years old. That's what I'm going to say, to count as an old game. So half the ones we mentioned wouldn't have made it for our role.
I've had Binary Domain sitting in my Xbox waiting to play again on 120 FPS mode for ages, and I haven't done it yet.
120.
Yeah.
I might do that.
I think I might do it soon.
Well, we can't wait for that that report. Joe, you've got an email.
You're damn right I do. It's from James Mole. He says, right, chaps, long time, first time and all that. Here's the thing. This sounds important. I found the podcast off the back of stumbling on Prepare to Try way back when. And to be honest, Rory Cooper and Gav looked exactly how I assumed they would in my mind's eye, if that makes sense.
So if you didn't listen to last week's episode, Joe, we put a call out for people to write in what do they think we look like if they've never seen us before.
I am slightly interested in this, given that you say you watched Prepared to Try and then they looked like how you expected them to. Doesn't make sense. You've seen them on screen first. So, James, picking holes in your story. Anyway, so cut to me listening to the podcast for years without ever seeing your faces. Apologies. I've never been an avid social media user. And by this point, I was pretty confident I had a solid idea. Why should I doubt myself? Oh, how wrong I was. The closest doppelgangers I can think of each of my auditory hallucinations are as follows. I fucking love this. I read this earlier. Cardi. Captain America, but before the Super Soldier Serum.
It starts off so well. But do you know what? I'm still... A weedy Chris Evans is still a good looking
skinny
man.
Chris Evans is good.
But yeah, I'm not like that. I'm much more... Well, I don't know what you'd... An even plumper Jesse Plemons?
Dale, somewhere between Carl Pilkington and Jason Statham if he'd never hit the gym.
Do you know what? That's kind of not... That's
I think not, Dale would be
not
upset.
A million miles away. But I don't think Dale's never hit...
Dale hits
not a
the
weedy
gym.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dale looks great.
But, you know, he's not Jason Statham. I think he'd admit that.
I don't think he would. Jesse, I can't find a famous equivalent.
Sorry, I just said... Stand up image of Dale in Crank 3.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to be fair, if like a lot of things that I can think of as who would fare best in the podcast crank. Group, Dale would deal with the Crank situation well, I think. He'd find all sorts of ways to keep the heart going. Jesse, I can't find a famous equivalent, but having now seen a team photo, I actually thought Cardi was Jesse, except my Jesse has a magnificent beard. So okay, is that so essentially Cardi with a beard?
So yeah, is what he thought Jesse looked like.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, okay.
Joe, an enigma wrapped in a mystery with all the accents and voices he does. I didn't realise I do accents and voices as much. I do silly voices, that is true.
Yeah.
But he always had tight curly hair like early Justin Timberlake.
So just any like a shapeshifter, but the hair stays the same.
Yeah.
You don't have curly hair at all, do you?
I don't. I have wavy hair at best. Emma. Her calm and quiet voice always makes me think of Elliot Page in Juno if she was perpetually wearing a hoodie up. I think is quite a poetic way to describe someone. Like someone who always seems like they've got a hoodie up. It's like quite an urban poetry thing to say.
Yeah.
Al.
This one's great.
So simple. 90s Alan Shearer. Which is a real compliment. Alan Shearer was beautiful in the 90s.
Oh, I like it. And he did have quite tight curly hair
in his Southampton days. Gorgeous young man.
Oh, Matt.
Was that 90s? Anyway.
Yeah. Matt, you've got off well.
This
here.
Is good. Matt, very tall, very slim, Neil Patrick Harris with a sprinkle of Jared Leto.
Oh, hello. That's quite nice.
Just a pure visual comparison to Jared Leto is great. Yeah. Just as long as there's no personality traits that are shared.
Do you know what? I would say with the, I wouldn't say, you know, you're not super tall. But,
no,
you know,
no. A mere 5'10" Cardi.
Yeah, but, you know, Neil Patrick Harris, he's not a lookalike for you.
No,
but, you
not,
know,
a
it's not
a million
miles.
Away. Yeah.
Yeah. Similar hair.
And then we've also got a description of Alicia, who hasn't been on this podcast for years, but we'll include it. Alicia, comedian Cariad Lloyd, the girlfriend of Jeremy's boyfriend in Peep Show Series 9.
That's not a million miles away.
No. Hi, Alicia. Would be intrigued to know if anyone else fits those descriptions at all. I think we've covered it. Mostly not. Cheers for the many years of entertainment and for looking forward and for something to look forward to every Friday. I would say the weekend is also up there, but, you know, I'm glad we're part of it. And for God's sake, show some consideration and high regard for the ocean.
Do not drown.
Don't drown.
Thank you for the email. Yeah, that was quite fun. And do you know what? Some of those weren't too wrong either, so that's always good.
It's like curly-haired mystery boy is I'm very pleased with.
I don't often keep that mystery. Like, if I'm listening to a podcast now, within like an episode or two, I'm finding what that person looks like. I like to have it right in my head.
I like it when there's pictures on the podcast art, but I don't know which ones are which. Like, I got all of Last Podcast on the Left from their art confused with each other for about a year until I saw them in person. I was like, oh shit, I've got that.
They've
all
switched
wrong.
Voices.
Yeah. That's some Freaky Magic. Friday shit.
I've got a last email here from Jack Churchill, who says, hello, IGN crew. Hope you're having a delightful day.
I am.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. I recently got to thinking about how Fallout 4 survival mode turns an otherwise fairly okay RPG into a genuinely fantastic experience.
Just want to say, what were you doing? Are you just sitting down having toast, being like, Fallout 4 survival mode? It's a fairly okay RPG. Genuinely fantastic after I put that on.
Having your toast. One day, I'll write an exhaustive essay, on it because I'm a dweeb. But for now, I wanted to ask, are there any other games where altering one thing, changing one setting, unlocks the real fun or potential of the game for you? Even a small thing like turning the HUD off in God of War 2018 or knocking down the difficulty in Wolfenstein The New Colossus, for example. I just think it's an interesting thing. Anyway, big fan of the show. Much love to you. And of course, respect the sea. Big up Poseidon.
Big up Poseidon.
Poseidon, indeed.
You've given my answer. Difficulty down in Wolfenstein, the two new Wolfenstein games. Mm-hmm. They are so much better when you don't have to pay attention to any of the fucking mechanics, because they're slightly boring games to play.
You don't want killing Nazis to be a chore.
No. Same goes for Jedi Fallen Order. Turn that down to easy.
Absolutely.
Much better game.
I was trying to think of one like this, and I couldn't.
Turning on inverted controls in literally any game.
Any game, yes.
That's correct.
Inverted is the correct way.
That unlocks the fun for me, because I can play it.
Yeah. Not a specific setting, but ignoring the idea that you have to play Arkane's games in stealth. Mm-hmm. Like literally just, like, the beauty of immersive sims, and this applies to, like, also Deus Ex and stuff like that, is stealth is a tool in an inventory of many other tools, and you should never be afraid to fucking chuck a grenade onto a rat and have that rat run into a group of people. Like, there are so many cool things that I think, particularly Dishonored, because people feel like the game punishes them for being, and to a degree I suppose it does, like, you will lead to the harsher endings, but you will have a lot more fun if you're willing to stab several men in very, very, like, floral fashion, basically.
I'm not sure it's the only way to play them, but I, in terms of, like, unlocking a different way to play, I definitely thought, when I played Medieval Total War back in the day, going in without the mindset of, like, doing everything right and doing it more for fun. Like, I had one game where I purposely tried to breed the worst possible king. Like, I was just making people, like, have babies with worse and worse inherited traits. And that became its own little game. I thought that was fun.
I do think a recent example would be Deathloop, having the full online turned on, not having Juliana played by the CPU, is a much more interesting, having an actual enemy Juliana invading your game regularly makes it the game. I think the game that's Joe shaking your head. It makes it a much harder game.
It does. I liked it more when I wasn't stressed.
I get that, but you know, That's the way that's meant to be played.
I'm looking at my games, trying to work it out. These days, playing the original Halo games in co-op, like
any game in co-op to me is a better game, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
As is life.
Damn right. Damn right. Yeah. It's all love, baby. I can't think of any others. Well, I think we've given a few. Turning off the HUD in God of War 2018 is super interesting. Like, I would never have thought to do it. And I would probably forget everything I could do. But
it's very minimal HUD, because I'm literally playing it at the moment. Yeah. It's actually a very minimalized HUD to begin with, so I'm kind of fascinated to know what kind of feeling it actually generates.
Emotion. Yeah. I mean, this is not changing anything about it, but I guess it kind of counts, like, just playing Elden Ring and not feeling like you're cheating by doing magic, like, that unlocked it for me.
I was thinking, like, that was the same, you know, I had a little rant about this when, I think, when we spoke about Elden Ring to begin with, like, just summon to your heart's content. It's, like, way fun when you have other people with you.
Oh, yeah.
Doing stuff like big bosses where you've got four other players with you. I don't know what I've only ever done it with two other players in Elden Ring, but I can't remember, but I know that Dark Souls 3 supported like loads of people and you could go in with like essentially the whole Fellowship of the Ring with you just absolutely fucking wailing on a boss. But when I did like, you know, everybody knows that Milena is a really fucking difficult boss and I fought her with two people and one of them had got Rykard's blasphemous sword, which can knock her on the floor, and it was hilarious to have him doing that and then me and another guy with a massive warhammer just wailing on her like floundering body.
I did it with the aid of one delightful companion called Andor the Mad, who just literally just fired super powerful spells out of his head. It was incredible. But yeah, I love him and always will. But yeah, maybe that's another one, sending feedback of something that unlocked a game for you to IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com.
I think that's super interesting. I would love to hear more of those.
Oh, yeah. What a delightful podcast that was. I had a lovely time.
Seems like it.
Oh, yeah. we've got to play some Top Gun music, haven't we?
Yeah.
Top Gun theme.
Just do this with me. What a tune.
I might go with the guitar version. But yeah, there we go. Here's some Top Gun music. Goodbye.
Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.